All right. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the House of the Risen Sun with Lynn and Bruce. And let me just mute the room so that I can hear. And let's see if Bruce is here. Bruce, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm great. I'm sorry for the long wait. Skype would not let me sign in.
Oh, no problem.
It said I was already signed in, and so it just, but it wouldn't let me access my account. So that's what's happening today. So that's all right, because Bruce or Devin and Barb will not be here this morning. So if we go a little over, that's cool. But anyway, good morning, Bruce. How are you doing this morning?
I'm good. And how is everyone else?
Pull
from the seeming else other factor in the world.
I don't know. I tell you, well, you know, whatever we think it is, it's not. That's the thing.
Yeah,
whatever it is not. If you think it's something, then you better believe that it's not that, because ego is always wrong.
Yeah,
not just sometimes.
Exactly, and it really ties into this morning's workbook lesson, which is about, you know, giving and receiving being the same, and how easily, as egos, we, you know, seemingly identified with that crazy thought system, we believe in that. Huh? We think that you know, things can benefit or detriment ourselves as separate cells, and you know, what a crazy notion that is. You know, we're at the whim of circumstance. To parody the Billy Joel theme from the Bosom Buddies show years ago. I never said I was a victim of circumstance, right?
That's true. And yet we believe that we're total victims of everything. Mm-hmm. And I've been seeing that a lot, just in general, the victim mentality that is just so prevalent. Well, it's the ego's main mode of operation. Because it always comes from a place that I'm being unfairly treated.
Yep.
And so if I'm being unfairly treated, then I'm going to have, you know, some kind of grievance, and it's going to be justified, and it justifies everything up to and including murder, genocide. Everything is all justified by that belief that I'm a victim. Mm-hmm. So, wow, you know, what a. And it's so easy. You know, I could believe I was a victim of Skype, because Skype would not open. And it was, you know, those people surprised.
Lynn Johnson, charter member of SVA, Skype Victims Anonymous.
Exactly. It doesn't matter what it is. If it's not to my liking, or it's not matching what I think should be happening, then I am going to be its victim as long as I believe that something should be different. And that's what all these lessons are pointing us to, is, you know, this understanding that it is only by knowing and understanding the sameness of everything that we come to know what it is, not the differences. And the differences are what make they're the basis for grievance. I mean, look at first thing, Cain and Abel. What was the problem with Cain and Abel? Abel sacrificed animals and God liked that. Cain sacrificed the fruits of the field and God was displeased. So right then and there, God said, I like this better than I like that. And so
the beef, huh?
It was the beef. It was literally the beef. And, you know, God demanded blood sacrifice. So Cain slew Abel. You know, he said, wow, you want blood. Here you go, buddy. And, started the whole thing. It's really kind of the beginning of all the insanity that.
And we've been unable ever since. Is that?
We've been unable ever since. That's right.
But speaking of Old Testament, I think I might have mentioned this before. It's been two or three weeks now, I guess, since I've finished reading Bob Rosenthal's wonderful book, From Plagues to Miracles. And it's about the journey of Exodus from you know, slavery to freedom, and you know, the metaphor in that you know, book in the Old Testament, and it's just brilliantly done. If you haven't read it, I highly recommend it to anyone who hasn't read it. And I'm going to be talking with Bob again about a week or so. But we've had two conversations that I've recorded, video conversations that I put on ACIMblog.com, and we'll be having a third soon, which will cover the second half of that book, which is kind of like after the, for the most part, it's the after the parting of the Red Sea story, and how they wander around in the desert, but they get their daily manna, you know, which is sort of like our daily reminders, which kind of ties into, you know, after we've sort of realized that the ego isn't working for us, you know, we suffer all these plagues and and you know, we're still not out of the woods yet, because we still, you know, even if we metaphorically might be past the 50% mark of our predominant identity / thought system, going from ego to Holy Spirit, and which again is just, it's not necessarily a numerical value, but just at some point we kind of recognize that, you know, the ego is not going to work for us, and it becomes, you know, a secondary, you know, a choice of identity. But then when we get across the Red Sea, according to, you know, Bob's symbolic, wonderful, brilliant metaphors, he suggested, well, the manna from heaven really is remembering to trust moment to moment or daily that we get what we need in order to you know, keep the peace that we want, which of course we never left, but the manna then is really, it's provided for us, and our, not only our forgiveness classrooms provided for us, but the one that does the forgiveness, which is that thought system of inclusion that we took with us into the dream that we call Holy Spirit or Jesus of the Course, or inner kindness teacher, or whatever label you like, that identity does it for us. It basically supersedes ego silliness and provides what we need in order to truly have a peaceful and fulfilling existence, or seeming existence in the world, which we realize isn't even in the world, which I think ties back into this FAQ. Did you get the... Does that sound good to you?
It does sound good to me, and I wanted to, based on what you're talking about, today's lesson, all that I give is given to myself. Mm-hmm. You know, this really is, and he says, today's idea, completely alien to the ego and the thinking of the world, is crucial to the thought reversal that this course will bring about. If you believed this statement, that all that I give is given to myself, there would be no problem in complete forgiveness, certainty of goal, and sure direction. You would understand the means by which salvation comes to you and would not hesitate to use it now. And so, you know, what is he talking on the means by which salvation comes to you? Well, it's that same reason by which the manna from heaven comes all the time. If we were out wandering in the desert and the manna from heaven came and I gathered mine and you gathered yours, and I said to you, hey, look, I have this exclusive manna here, and my exclusive manna is wonderful because it was collected in a purple basket, whereas yours was collected in a blue basket. So my purple basket manna is even better than your blue basket manna. And now I'm going to keep it all to myself because it's so wonderful. You would just look at me and go, you are so full of crap. I got the same manna you got. We all got the same manna. It all came to us. You can't give me anything I don't have already. Nor do I want anything that you could possibly give me. So it's true. We all have received the same thing. None of us has received anything different than anyone else. So if
the whole, the whole basis for comparison and jealousy and differences and making big deals over what appear to be inequities and victims and victimizers and all the seeming slights and disadvantages and advantages in the world just disappear if non-duality is true.
Exactly. Yeah. And you know, the whole basis for believing it is to see that, you know, it brings you peace.
Right.
And you know, what else, what other purpose would there be? You know, if you think that, you know, if I, what I have, I give to you, means that I'm going to have a loss, then there's not going to be any peace involved in me giving you something, because I'm always going to regret it and wish that I had it back. Or I'm always going to be thinking you didn't do the right thing with what I gave you. Or, you know, I'm going to have a judgment or an idea about what you should be doing with what I'm giving to you. Whereas, you know, God has no judgment on what he's given. He's given us everything, and he has he doesn't give a crap what we do with it. He could care less what we do with it. You know, we could turn it into a world and make ourselves suffer and be afraid and die. And he does not care even a little bit, because he gave us everything, and he knows that it cannot be diminished by any of our antics. Right. And so there again, you know, giving and receiving are the same. That's basically what this is saying here.
Yep, and it ties in perfectly with the course's incessant, but wonderfully so, a reminder that its curriculum is always and only about the mind. And because on the level of form or behavior, if I give you a pencil or $1 million or a crumb of bread, I have one less of those things, you know, by the world's reckoning. But in truth, if I give you a thought, I have it, and so do you. And that's the whole difference of the shift between identity of as form, as bodies and personas that are completely wedded to those bodies. And the course's, you know, gentle but persistent suggestion that we're minds, and or really a mind that appears to have fragmented into countless seemingly individual minds, and it gently argues against that individuality. that's kind of come up for me lately. Is it like the individual is individuality is has the word duality in it, and that can be a reminder that if I'm, you know, invested in what's in it for me, boy, I'm really barking up the wrong tree in terms of my peace and happiness. Just a quick aside, last Sunday I attended remotely, for anybody in the Denver area, the Rocky Mountain Miracle Center has some wonderful programs, and one of them is only quarterly, and it meets, you know, four times a year, and is facilitated by Chris Dixon Bubik, and she does a wonderful job, and we go over one of the profoundly rich, deep articles that Ken Wapnick wrote in the Lighthouse series. And so this one was no exception. You can go to the Rocky Mountain Miracle site and find it. The link to it's basically about, you know, do no harm. And it's one that Ken and Gloria wrote that has some really, really wonderful. Let me find that link real quick so you can post it in the room if you want. It really has some great reminders to look at the insanity of ego's values and motivations, it's really, really, I mean, it's challenging, because none of us want to do that, because if we really look at that and expose the
that the emperor is naked.
Yeah, exactly. If when we look at that, we realize, God, there's no reason I would want to, you know, invest in that. It's just crazy. It's just totally crazy. So I think I'm almost to the link here. Because, you know, it basically points out the selfishness and the crassness and the banality of that thought system. Okay, I'm at the sitemap now, so let me grab the link, and then I'll post it there. And it is the Lighthouse. Here we go. Found it. Okay. Yeah, this was last Sunday, and it's got the link to it in here. So I'll put that in the chat window for...
All right. Now I'll post it in the
Skype, and then you can... then I'll put the link that it leads to here, which is Do No Harm to Anyone. Here it is. Yeah, so the first link is the one for the session that happened last Sunday at the Rocky Mountain Miracle Center. But that's also useful for people that might be in the Denver area that would like to participate in the programs there. There's a lot of really great stuff. And this is the article that it refers to, the second link I just posted there, which is the Do No Harm to Anyone article. But I'm going to reread this a few times because I think there's so much in there. In fact, maybe I should just set a calendar reminder about once a month to go through this.
That's great. And I love the idea of do no harm. I mean, really, that's what we're for. And we're here to be truly helpful.
Yeah, exactly. So we're all doctors. It starts out with referring to the reference to the Hippocratic Oath, above all, do no harm kind of thing. But that's really it. Is if we do no harm to anyone, well, that's including everyone, which basically is the shared interest again. So it's actually a really simple and kind of obviously sane alternative to the world's thinking. Is that if we are just not even necessarily kind, but if we're not harmful, I mean, just a zero sum game kind of thing, kindness usually seems like it implies effort. But if we could just refrain from harming anyone or anything, wow, that really is the kindness, because it's basically just saying, I will not, damage or demean or degrade any part of God's creation. And again, it has nothing to do with the level of form. It doesn't mean that you don't use disinfectant because you might be killing bacteria. It doesn't
step on a bug or
It's basically watching the contents of your mind from moment to moment, and saying kind of one of those mini maxims of the course of such as would I accuse myself of this?
Right.
Would I be willing to condemn myself with the accusation and the condemnation that I'm dishing out to whoever seems to be in my path and in my way today, and just looking at that stuff and just saying, wow, the ego is just this vicious, brutal, monster that we've become. It's become so socially acceptable, which kind of ties into a political commentary I was listening to last night of when that's the new norm and we don't even think that to question, the norm that's insane. And it was referring to a certain political situation in this country, which we could spend a whole, and have spent whole sessions on, but it's just kind of like looking at the craziness of thinking that, condemnation of anyone or anything is an acceptable and sane way of living, and of course it really isn't, because that's really what brings about all the misery in this apparent world that we believe that we're in.
Exactly. And what is that? I mean, this lesson is talking about this very thing, because he's saying, let's look at what you do believe.
Right.
He's saying, obviously you believe something that is invalid. Let's look at what you do believe. And it seems to you that other people are apart from you and able to behave in ways which have no bearing on your thoughts, nor yours on theirs. Therefore, your attitudes have no effect on them, and their appeals for help are not in any way related to your own. You further think that they can sin without affecting your perception of yourself, while you can judge their sin and yet remain apart from condemnation and at peace. So he's pointing out the intricate relationship between what we consider cause and effect. And we think, and he's saying, if you look at your brother and believe that he is wrong and condemn him, because he thinks differently or he has a different kind of thought about things, which is really all we argue about. This is all we worry about with other people, is their thoughts. People don't go and suicide bomb in a marketplace because, somebody stepped on their toe yesterday. They're doing it because they have a thought that they are being persecuted. They have a thought that they need to do something about it. They have a thought that punishing other people will cause a change in the way people act and react. So these are all thoughts. I have an idea. I have a thought. Let me try this out. And so they act on their thoughts, which causes a lot of havoc for a lot of other people as well, and plus, you know, kills them because if they're suicide bombing. But so because of a thought, because of an idea, someone will cause mayhem in the physical world to and act out and cause all kinds of grief. It's all because of thoughts. So if we can go to the thought and look at the thought and question the thought, and, you know, this is what Byron Katie is all about, is questioning these thoughts and asking, you know, are they true? And when, you know, I begin to perceive that none of my thoughts are true, which is what these lessons are all about, is to teach you that no thought of the ego is true or could be true or could change what God is or what God has made. So the idea that, first off, you were talking about thoughts. Thoughts are not diminished by being shared. That's right. The other thing. The power of thought is that it's not diminished by being shared. So if we share thoughts, what happens is that they become more alive and become more detailed, and you have more thoughts, and, you know, so thought itself is neutral, and yet, depending on my interpretation of the thought, I can either choose to harm or help. And, so again, you know, it's getting back to the origin of the grievance. It comes from the thought. It doesn't come from any action. It doesn't come from anything in the world. It comes from my mind. So then in the next paragraph, he says, when you forgive a sin, there is no gain to you directly. You give charity to one unworthy merely to point out that you are better on a higher plane than he whom you forgive. So, you know, Jesus is pointing out again, he put that forgive in quotes. If I look at you and think that there's something wrong and bad about you, or that you're doing something you shouldn't be doing, then I am not going to actually forgive you because I've already judged you, and I can't forgive what I already judged.
Right. We have to look at the foundation in the mind and see its invalidity before forgiveness makes sense. I think that's repeated countless places throughout the text and the workbook and the manual and elsewhere and the supplement, is that, you know, that I was thinking even in the Song of Prayer, the secret of true prayer is to forget the things you think you need. Well, we think we need to get revenge because of, you know, what has been done to us. Well, if the world, is of our own making, first of all, that we don't need revenge on anyone else. And secondly, if we then apply the East, you know, look at the motivation, and secondly, if we look at the nature of the surreality of matter, energy, time and space, bodies, form, seeming substance, which is basically mostly empty space, even within the realm of physics, on a macroscopic and a microscopic scale, we realize that, okay, well, there's really nothing here that needs forgiveness. So not only does it essentially solves itself in two ways, in that it removes the cause as being from something outside of ourselves, the locus of control returns to the mind, and it also shows that there were no violations or infringements or attacks made on the holiness and the oneness of the identity that we really have, you know, the God Son that the Course talks about, which is all of us, not just a particular individuality, person, individual. So that lets everybody off the hook. So that means that if we're willing to consider that, and that section in the workbook lesson you just read, Lynn, as I was reading it this morning, it's like, yeah, what a great parody, a parody of the you know, fanatically insane, you know, misunderstanding that the ego has made and promoted and, you know, essentially we've foisted upon ourselves by listening to this voice of insanity. And it's just crazy. So forgiveness really based on the world's thinking has no basis, and it does seem like it's unmerited and unfounded, and it's a big deal that we're doing for someone else, but the Course keeps reminding us that the true forgiveness that it's talking about is and our salvation, which I'm going to be talking to Susan Dugan about and tying in together in a few days. That's really our only task here is to accept the salvation for ourselves, which is to forgive ourselves for all that we thought transpired in the world, and that it had no effect on our eternal identity, our eternal oneness and holiness and innocence and all that good stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, and it has given up this belief in the ego, basically is what it is, has given up the belief in the ego as being a valid arbiter of truth.
Right.
And recognizing that that if it came up, if it's like that line from the Paper Moon where the father asks the little girl, do you know what scruples are? And she says, I don't know what they are, but if you've got them, you can bet they belong to somebody else.
And that's a great quote. Oh, that's, I mean, talk about, you know, I mean, and we can laugh at it because we can all, I think we all relate to it is, you know, we all think that somebody else has something we need. And that's the insanity again, you know, and why I just pulled up, a quote and found a, didn't really find this, another FACIM, essay here that starts out in the first paragraph with the what is not love is murder quote. So I'll give you that one to post in the room if you want. But of course that quote doesn't make any sense at all on the level of form, because obviously if we aren't expressing on the level of form something that appears to be loving, to say that everything is murderous, I mean, then the entire planet would be locked up. Every microbe to whale would be incarcerated based on that. And so what other intergalactic beings we could muster, you know, ETs, you know, the whole lot of us, we'd all be locked up for murder, because the whole premise of the material world is that there's something outside us that can affect our peace. And, you know, of course says, well, if there is no world, then there is no murder. But then that whole premise then falls apart, then, doesn't it?
So. Oh, yeah. You know, it's real interesting that you even bring that up, because this morning when I was making my coffee and I was reflecting on the different kind of dietary things that people are doing and how a lot of people have gone vegan, and they're going vegan is a result of wanting to be harmless, you know, to do no harm. And yet, you know, what what's the difference in the life? I mean, this, because this is all an illusion, there's no such thing as a real cow or a real blade of grass. These are all thoughts in our mind. And
Oh, I was just going to say, and then there's those vicious breatharians ripping apart oxygen molecules mercilessly, you know,
exactly.
And with each breath.
Exactly. You know, everything we do is, I mean, this is the world, this world is the killing ground for the ego. It's everything is being, is kill or be killed.
Right.
And kill and be killed, because that's just the way it works. It's the circle of life, you know, I mean.
Even without killer bees, it would be a killer bee killed world, right?
Even without killer bees, who have become a lot tamer now. They've bred with domestic or, you know, less lethal bees. And maybe they took a few anger management classes or something. So yeah, killer bees are not.
So now that population is more civil on the world's terms, even though it's still secretly harboring thoughts of murder, but just in a more politically
Exactly.
Okay. All right.
I'm politically correct bees. but so anyway, where were we?
Okay. Well, should we move over to the FAQ?
Yeah, let's go over and look at the FAQ.
Because I think there's a lot. I think we can spend an hour talking about that pretty easily.
Yeah, today's lesson, I'm guaranteeing you, once you get the idea and understanding of what Jesus is talking about in this lesson, then it makes it so simple to just give and give and give and give and give and give, because you recognize it's not the world that is real. It's my brother that's real. And if I think that somehow or the other, withholding love, withholding forgiveness, withholding anything from my brother, doing tough love, that's an extreme example, but if you are practicing what they call tough love, which basically means that you don't give in to the demands or the whims of another person in order to kind of help them understand their values or boundaries or whatever. The reality of it is, any love that isn't just holy love, well, in fact, all expressions of love are maximal. We do know that. So even if I am punishing you in order to try to modify your behavior, it's still love, and it's still a maximal expression of love. It may not be perceived as such because of the way that it's being done, nor will it work as such because of the perception, how people perceive it. But any kind of love that isn't just complete open and giving and recognizing that whatever I give, I receive myself, it's all conditional.
Yeah.
And so, Jesus is saying, take out the conditions. That's all it is. Just take out the conditions. Don't forgive to destroy by making conditions upon salvation, about saying, well, if you'll only do this or do that, or if you only act this way, or if, you think this or you say this, then we'll get along. That is not, it doesn't matter who it is, and it doesn't matter what our relationship with them is. If we don't accept them unconditionally and love them unconditionally, then we are forgiving to destroy, and we can't have a whole relationship with another person or ourselves or God.
Yeah, which ties in perfectly to that FACIM essay on doing no harm, is if we look at our motivations and realize that the least little bit of investment in an outcome basically doesn't change reality, but it cuts us off from the peace that's there waiting for us every moment.
Right. We just don't see. We can't. It's invisible to us.
Yeah.
We can't even see it. And this is why, throughout the lessons, things like, I could see peace instead of this.
Right.
Yes, you can immediately. This is what is so amazing. It's immediate.
Mm-hmm.
Once you make the decision that this is all I want to see, and whenever anything comes up, you just say, this is not it. No, I'm not looking at that. That has nothing to do with me. Fear, jealousy, upset, anger, all that kind of stuff. Any of those feelings that come up, I just have to look at them and say, this is, no, I'm not going to accept that. I only want peace. And therefore, and I'm going to see peace.
Yeah, that infinite patience is the... the trigger for the immediate result of letting go of the fear and the unconscious guilt and the pain that is an interpretation of the mind that says that this world is my identity, and and you know, what endangers it endangers me kind of thinking. And that's just, it's just whacked out. It's just, I mean, when we really look at that honestly and read A Course in Miracles as the parody it is of the ego, we can't afford from above that battleground to gently laugh, not in a derisive way, but gently laugh at all of our investment in ego and see that we all really want to, you know, reinvest in our heritage that we couldn't, in our birthright that we can't even throw away, which is that we are beloved of this perfect oneness that we could call God if we want, that, that has no, no opposite, no polarity, no duality, and no cognizance, as you pointed out earlier this morning, Lynn, of anything that is not itself. And that awareness is the gentle, you know, manifest in the gentle promptings that we have to just look at the mind, see when we've picked up the sword again and we're fighting, you know, a Don Quixote windmill again, you know, or whatever the mechanism for warfare that we've chosen, and just say, wow, that's just silly. Why am I doing that again? Why do I need to battle what does not affect my true reality?
Yes, and it comes down to that opinion thing. It's this idea that I know what's right. And there's the operative word right there.
There's the rub.
Being right.
Rightness is the rub. Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
It is the whole thing. Because that's all ego wants, is to be right. And ego wants to be right about the way I brush my teeth. The ego wants to be right about the how much water I run. The ego wants to be right about the spiritual practices that I do, my diet, my people that I associate with. You know, there's all a whole feeling in my mind of you know, okay, it's right that if I be a vegetarian, it's right that I don't run the water while I'm, am I not good? I'm brushing my teeth, but I'm not running the water until I'm done. You know, I'm being good. This is ego telling me I'm right. This is all these opinions of things that are happening in the world and my behaviors in the world being either good or bad or up or down or right or wrong. That's ego's whole ploy to keep me involved in my rightness. So if it's right that I do yoga every day, or if it's right that I, you know, take the dog out for a walk, or it's right that I say hello to strangers, or, you know, whatever my ego is telling me is the right thing to be doing, I'm listening to it.
Mm-hmm. And there's always exceptions to its rules. Like, for example, it's okay in some of ego's, schools of thought for vegetarians to eat vegetables. But in some schools, and similar schools, in fact, it's not okay for humanitarians to eat humans. So it's always this fickle, you know, changeability, right?
Exactly. So I saw something on somebody posted on Facebook about sometime back in the 1800s or something, some Dutch ruler was murdered and eaten. So I don't know if that really happened, but it cracked me up. Like, oh, they resort to cannibalism. That's it. It's all cannibalism.
Exactly.
That's all
food,
it is.
Food for breakfast thought, right?
Food for breakfast thought. So let's look at this question and answer.
Yeah, do you want to start reading the
I'll read the
two
question.
Paragraphs?
Yeah. And I'll read the whole question and then we can go on to the answers.
Okay.
So I was sitting in the library one evening and I noticed a certain book glowing. There was just something about it that made me know I need to read it. So I took the random book and it turned out to be A Course in Miracles. I spent much time over the last 6 years not only studying the course, but other spiritualities, philosophies, and thought systems. I have reached the conclusion that nothing in this universe actually exists except the minds of the people. I absolutely do not believe in matter. I absolutely do not believe in matter.
What's the matter with this person?
I believe we had a mass consciousness believing along the same lines. This believe. This entire world as we see it would disappear and the sonship would become reunited. Don't get me wrong, though. I do believe that all works of good that a fellow brother does for another will be remembered for eternity in God's mind. But everything else will be erased when full atonement is achieved. It's not like this person did their homework and they read the book.
Actually, the last paragraph, which I've read a little, skipped ahead a little bit, the last paragraph of the FAQ's answer ties in beautifully with what the quote that this person just had there in this, the last part of that first paragraph of the question. Yeah.
All right. Well, good. So. I'll be interested to get there. Until the majority of the sonship has realized this, we are bound by this illusion of matter. So the question remains, how do we convince people in such a materialistic world that matter doesn't matter? How do we convince people who put so much faith in their bodies that their bodies are illusions? And for those of us who understand these things,
we're laughing gently at all of our seemingly separate selves here, right, Lynn?
I understand this.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Why isn't it working?
Really? How come my separate self is so dysfunctional? Huh?
I What's believe up with that? This. Why isn't it working? Oh, my God, I'm dying. All right. This is just the sweetest question. It's adorable. Mm-hmm. Okay. For those of us who understand these things, how do we live in an illusory world, recognizing the absurdness of it all and pay attention to the illusion to some extent, for instance, not getting run over by cars, walking naked down the highway, etc. As I would be doing, that's exactly what I'd be doing, is walking naked and getting run over if I didn't have my ego to tell me what to do. Oh my God. All right. Too much fun too early in the morning.
It's painting too vivid a picture here, I think, for. But anyway, please go.
Okay. All right. Because it sounds as if the more we, quote unquote, play in the illusion, the more strength we are adding to that illusion as well. I firmly believe that this is the next logical evolutionary progression of the course. So now there's a logical evolutionary progression of the illusion. What do you think of what I consider to be the evolution of A Course in Miracles? Okay. All right. So, yes, there is an evolution of the illusion and The Course in Miracles. That's
Well, to paraphrase John Lennon, we all want to save the world, you know, when you talk about an evolution, right? Or a revolution. Doesn't really matter the time frame, if it's quick or slow. But shall I read the...
Sure, Jim Dunn said, if I walked naked, several cars would be trying to stop and pick you up. You haven't seen me naked, Jim. I think there'd be several people driving off the road, like, holy crap. Anyway,
We're all naked emperors here, but
that's right.
I'll go on. So just for anybody who might have just joined us, and so that if I edit this later, which I've been doing more and more lately, I can listen to it and find which one we were talking about. This is FAQ number 1297 from the Foundation for A Course in Miracles website, facm.org, and they have a whole section called facmoutreach.org that has these 1,300-plus frequently asked questions. And Lynn just read the two-paragraph question of this particular FAQ, which is 1297, and I'll read the first paragraph of the answer that's provided. And it starts with, A Course in Miracles clearly teaches that the world and the body are illusory and that the world will disappear into the nothingness from which it came when we no longer want the purpose it serves. When not one thought of sin remains, the world is over. It will not be destroyed, nor attacked, nor even touched. It will merely cease to seem to be. And that word is the word. If you go through and reread A Course in Miracles and look for all the words seem and appear and all the variations on those words, it's amazing how many places it lets us off the hook where we imagine. And that's probably another word to look for. that's kind of akin to those words. How, you know, it's basically saying, well, this is, you know, a belief. It's because it seems to be. Okay, let me go on. And that's from part 14 of the manual, and also look at section 8 in chapter 20 in the text. And
I was also going to say, just real quickly, that that the reason I was laughing so much when I was reading the question is because of the word belief and believe that was used over and over and over.
Yes.
And recognizing how, oh my gosh, this was me. I believed this course. I believed these things. I believed that belief is not going to take away the effect of what appears to be the world.
Right.
All it's going to do is cause you to question it. Mm-hmm. And Jesus himself said, you know, if I didn't believe this, if I hadn't believed it, I would never have found this. And so a belief is essential at this point in our spiritual evolution.
yeah, because our beliefs then are the raw materials, the tools of the classroom that we use to get back into the mind. And because our beliefs then fabricate the experience on a level that was mostly unconscious to us, that comes back to us apparently independent of our own volition. But, you know, it's basically, it's kind of like that Star Trek episode where the little scanners, you know, read the minds and fabricate what's in, not necessarily in the individual minds, but in the collective. Then it's the kind of an amalgam. But each person's seeming individual's classroom is the perfect undo curriculum when given over to the Holy Spirit to look at, and that's why it's just so mathematically perfectly wonderful in the sense that we get to look at the craziness of the ego and gradually, by generalizing, realize that system of beliefs and the world of seeming and of appearances is really just a perspective that we've adopted that we can unadopt. Okay, so I'll continue with this paragraph here. So the world thus is not the problem, as it is nothing but a projection of the mind, the outside picture of an inward condition, which is the introduction from chapter 21. The course therefore teaches us to look within at what is causing us to project outward and identify with the form the projection takes. Look at what is causing us. Well, the causing, of course, is the thought system we've identified that's based on a whole bunch of erroneous beliefs about a world that only exists in fantasy. Yeah. But it sure seems real. It's a very photorealistic three-dimensional hologram that we've bought into completely. But we can unbuy into it through this practice. That is the core of its teaching and mind training exercises. So that's the first paragraph of the answer to FAQ 1297. Any comments on that before we go to the next?
Yeah. So, exactly. He's gone directly to the source of the it's the world is a freaking illusion.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
and the motivation for it as well.
Exactly, and the more we hash it over and hash it over, it doesn't make it more real. It just makes it more real in our mind. Mm-hmm. And that's why all this wondering about what to do in the world and trying to figure out what to do in the world, really for us, and just, you know, my opinion here, but for us, we've been taken out of that scheme. We are no longer a part of the evolution of the world. Excuse me. Because we have become miracle workers and teachers of God. So, you know, all of these things that are plaguing to, you know, everyone else in the world, we've already accepted that we're going to be looking at it from a different direction, and we're not going to be reinforcing the ego thought system anymore. So, all of these, anything that you're doing that's aimed at trying to make sense of the illusion or to redeem the illusion is really worthless activity. I mean, really worthless activity. It has no meaning whatsoever. So being a miracle worker does have a meaning, even though it's a temporary meaning of, getting us past this belief in the illusion. And when it's done, there'll be no more need for miracles or work at all. We're looking at it from our point of view. I'm hoping that we're looking at it from our point of view of, this is how I should be relating to myself in the world so that I can be, making this miracle, being in partnership with Jesus and the Sonship in the atonement and not be a detriment. unfortunately, there's a lot of Course in Miracles students who themselves have bought into some part of the illusion and decided to become a detriment, and meaning that, they're involved in politics and, trying to rearrange things in the political world, or they're involved in judging other Course in Miracles teachers and trying to modify their behaviors. This is just a kind of little plea here on my part to anyone who's listening to remember our purpose. And if we're being engaged in anything that is taking us off the purpose, then let us remember I'm one with God. Let us remember what we're here to do. When Ken or whoever wrote this is saying, let's look inside and see what's causing us to project outward and identify with the form projection takes. That's what we're here for. That's the core of what we're doing here. This is an everyday behavior activity for me and you and me. Okay, so the next paragraph says, early in the text, Jesus talks about the difficulty of getting through to us. Says, how can you teach someone the value of something he has deliberately thrown away? He must have thrown it away because he did not value it. You can only show him how miserable he is without it and slowly bring it nearer so he can learn how his misery lessens as he approaches it. This teaches him to associate his misery with absence and the opposite of misery with its presence. Okay, so you associate misery with its absence and the opposite of misery with its presence. It gradually becomes desirable as he changes his mind about its worth. I am teaching you to associate misery with the ego and joy with the spirit. You have taught yourself the opposites. You are still free to choose, but can you really want the rewards of the ego in the presence of the rewards of God? And I'm just going to stop right here. This is the question I think that is pivotal to answer right now. Because, we look at these, like the lessons, let me remember I'm one with God, all of the talk and the lessons about the feeling that I have or will have when I have this memory of God restored, this peace, this joy that will be mine when I feel the love of God within me now. And this is, if you have that feeling, you would never resort to judgment. You would never resort to attack. You would never resort to being harmful in any way at all because you have nothing but love and joy within you. And so there's not even there's not even a thought of attack in the mind of someone who is connected to their divine source in a very real and visceral way. You would think that if you ever had that experience, even a little bit, of feeling just totally loved, totally warm, held, protected, taken care of, if you'd ever have that feeling of being one with God or having God's love within you, then you could always resort back to that feeling whenever something was appearing to be going wrong or there appeared to be an upset, and and remember that knowledge of God's love. So, you know, this is what, you know, Jesus wants to inspire in us. And this is what Jesus wants to have us experience. This is why when we do these exercises and these lessons, you know, he says, you will have it. If you do this, you'll have an experience. And, you know, how many of us have done it and not had the experience, or have thought we were doing it, but we didn't have the experience? And so it really is a matter of, you know, desiring to have that experience of oneness. It's a matter of doing the exercises with hope and with an open mind, and also being consistent with it. You know, because it's not because it's being withheld from you. It's not because God is saying, well, you know, if you just get over this hurdle and do these workbook lessons, then I'll give you an experience of my love. That's not because of that at all. The experience of God's love is in you all the time. It is the core basis of your life. This is how you even exist in the world, is because you have, because you're the vessel of God's love. If you're not experiencing that in that way, then it's because you're resisting in some way. You're resisting by having an opinion about things. You're resisting through judgments. You're resisting through deciding that you want to be right. Whatever it is, it's not, you're not doing anything wrong. It's just the way that the ego acts and reacts when it is being given the option or being shown that that there's another way of seeing things. It will reject that other way. So it's a consistency in our desire and consistency in our purpose that brings us to the point where we do have this experience of the rewards of God. And once you're having this experience of the rewards of God, then you will not be enjoying the experience of the ego. And in fact, when the experience of the ego comes up, you're going to be going, what the hell? That's not how I want to feel right now. Yeah. And let it go. I mean, this is, it's simple, but you got to know what your purpose is.
Right. And I think so much of the course's curriculum is geared toward not so much reminding us that we want the peace of God, but just showing us how much we have invested in the appearance of an opposite that we on some level recognize is a very dysfunctional, maladaptive solution to this non-existent problem, as Ken points out over and over again. That, you know, we just need to look at the barriers, the awareness of love's presence, and look at our investment in those and see, wow, that is just silly. There's nothing evil or wicked about it. It's just silly. Why would I do that? But we don't recognize that from the ego, because that's the only thing the ego knows. So we have to, you know, identify with the part of us that is calling for love and say to ourselves, okay, I'm tired of being miserable. I really would prefer to have the peace that's been waiting there all along. So do you want to finish that second
paragraph? Yeah, I'll go ahead and finish that. And just to add a real little bit to what you just said, Bruce, how do I know when I'm even doing it? Well, it's real simple, and you'll find, or I have found, that is the major source of my entertainment. The major source of my entertainment is I love to go and look at Facebook and see what kinds of things people are saying about Trump, or what kinds of things people are saying about, I mean, really, whatever controversial thing or whatever upset is going on. And so I can look at it and have an opinion, and I can be right. Oh, my God. It's like, you know, it's sucking at the tit of the right bore, man. You're just over there just like, oh, my God. Look at
masochism,
how
junkies, huh?
Oh, these people are being unfairly treated. Oh my God, they're going to get me. The government's taking away all my, you know, money, my health care. You know, it's just like a fountain of objections and fears and, you know, I mean, so easy to just get into it and have all these thoughts and opinions about things. And also a good place to look at your mind and look at your thinking and look at your judgments and look at what, you know, what it is you're deciding to focus on and what your purpose is. You know, so if my purpose really is to be one with God, then, you know, what bait am I going to fall for when I go over there and I see, you know, I don't even know what kind of headline would make me react, but lots of them do. And then I react, I might even write something back, and for what? You know, for what? In order to just keep the cycle going. So,
I was picturing, you know, someone looking at the wiring in the mind, you know, metaphorically, and realizing if there's a button that's being pushed out in the world, whether it's a, you know, political situation or an environmental crisis or a relationship issue or a health issue, you know, pick your favorite genre of calamity. And we all have our favorites, and in all diverse ways. But just look at that and say, wow, maybe there's little sort of metaphorically invisible wires that I put out there, and I wired this button out in the world. So there's somebody walks along and steps on or pushes this button that says push me, in big flashing red letters. We only have ourselves to account for that, because we put that wiring in place, not on a conscious level, but on an unconscious level. We asked for this world that was designed to keep us mindless and designed to keep us at the mercy of, instead of merciful to ourselves and each other. So that, I mean, that's where it really, you know, it becomes this ongoing curriculum of just looking at, oh, okay, I'm going to unwire that button. Okay. And I'm going to unwire that button. And, but there's, you know, millions of buttons that we've put in place on an unconscious level that basically say, I'm at the mercy of what's going on. And exactly. we retrieve that victimhood and disassemble it. And dismantle it power it down by each moment that we forgive ourselves for having made up a dream where we could be at the whim of some circumstance seemingly outside ourselves. And that's kind of the flip side of the giving, receiving equation that we started our conversation this morning with.
Exactly. Well, here again, though, we did make these consciously.
I did consciously say
Christians are good. I think that wearing a hijab or whatever they call that thing that women wear is a bad thing. I think we put those things in place and we reaffirm them over and over. And that's where I, you know, get to the where it is that I actually actively put things in place, made up rules, made up ideas about how things should be, made up ideas about how people should be and how people should act and react, and made up all that stuff. And, you know, if I just look at it, I recognize, oh, I made that up. Oh, yeah, sure, I did. You know, I'm the one that said monogamy is the only way. And so if my husband has a girlfriend, ooh, I'm offended. If I hadn't have said that, if I hadn't have made that idea or had that idea, and I even had an idea that, you know, that you could or should limit love in one way or another. You know, here's an idea that says you should love only me. You know, how did I get that? Well, because I had this idea about this and I saw this and I saw. So the whole time we've been building up these rules and regulations about how to be and what's acceptable and what's not. And just to realize, I made it all up. God did not make a single rule in this world. Not a single rule in this world was made by God. Not a single belief in this world was made by God. I made it all up.
Now, in terms of the God that we're talking about, it would be the Course's definition, which is a pure non-dual awareness that has no cognizance and no identification with a
right.
dream of separate interests and matter and energy and form and bodies and all that stuff. So, yeah.
Yeah, so there's no right or wrong. I mean, that's the because if you look at it, this is all wrong. And
so I guess we could paraphrase that with would you rather be right or wrong or happy? because the right and wrong are really two sides of the same illusory coin in ego's thought system, aren't they?
Exactly. It is the same exact thing. Okay, so the pedagogy, I hate this word, the pedagogy, which means like, I don't know, the intellectual or the, I don't know.
I think it's the thinking behind the curriculum.
The thinking behind
how,
okay.
how it's practiced and all that. And
all right.
Something like that. Course, I'd have to look it up.
Is well thought out. Okay. He just means says Jesus knows what he's talking about.
Right,
it means
right.
where we are and respects the choices we have made to disassociate ourselves from truth and love. While at the same time, so it respects the choice we made to make this mess. Okay. while at the same time, it shows us the disastrous consequences of those choices. It is never coercive or threatening, however, just abundantly clear about the mess we have made of everything, including our self-identity, why we have done it, and how to undo it all. It's that simple. It's just how we got here and how to undo it all. It's perfect. All right.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it really is.
It is, absolutely. Its approach is gentle and encouraging, reassuring us that there is no urgency, as ultimately time is unreal and we are undoing what never happened, which is the principle of the atonement. Everything we need to restore to our minds the awareness of love's presence is already in the Course. For those for whom this Course resonates, nothing more is needed. Other paths are available to those who are not comfortable with this one. And that's actually from the Manual for Teachers says that there's basically a course, course for everyone. So, but yeah, so all, you know, Ken or whoever is saying here is that, the Course is made to walk you through this undoing. And as we walk through this undoing, even if we don't believe it. You know, he says that in the introduction to the lessons. You don't even have to believe this.
Right. Just practice it.
Just practice it.
Yeah, exactly.
And that practice is everything because it shifts your entire thinking. Mm-hmm. Amazing. Yeah. Okay.
Okay, I'll go to the next paragraph. The Course often addresses the concern, to use your words, of how to, quote, live in an illusory world, recognizing the absurdness of it all, and pay attention to the illusion to some extent, i.e. not getting run over by cars, walking naked down the highway, etc., unquote. Lesson 155 teaches us, for example, that, quote, there is a way of living in the world that is not here, although it seems to be. You do not change appearance, though you smile more frequently. Your forehead is serene, your eyes are quiet, and the ones who walk the world as you do recognize their own. Yet those who have not yet perceived the way will recognize you also and believe that you are like them as you were before. And that's from Workbook Lesson 155. There is also a section in the Manual for Teachers that discusses this aspect of our process. How should the teacher of God spend his day? Should I read another one?
Sure.
Or do you want to comment on that one first?
No, I really don't. I mean, it's true. I think that you do recognize people who are in a different state of mind. And, you know, they don't necessarily, haven't necessarily done A Course in Miracles, but, you know, there are plenty of them out there in the world that you come into contact with. So, I think the idea of living in the illusory world, for Course in Miracles students, you come to a point where you recognize that Jesus will substitute for your ego if you let him. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you don't need to worry about if you're going to walk down the highway naked, because that may be part of your script. That may, you have no idea. But if you have your own opinion about what is right and what's wrong, what's good, what's bad, then you will never do, you know, whatever it is that you're being guided to. If, or you may do it, you will do it, but you'll do it reluctantly, or you'll have an opinion about it that it's not good. If you believe in wearing clothes and not walking on the highway, you know, that's there's two beliefs that, you know, need to be addressed if that's what you're doing. Just saying that our beliefs are what restrict us in our minds from accepting what our actions are, what our lives are, as according to the script, and allowing it to be as it is, and not having opinions about it, not being upset about the outcome, or believing that an outcome, that we know what the outcome should be. This is, again, all part of the ego wanting to be right. Mm-hmm. There's this idea that somehow or the other I can plan, I have some knowledge of what should be being done and what my part is. And, you know, what Jesus is saying is when you give up your belief that you know, then you are serene because you don't worry. You just accept what comes and smile. You just accept what comes and are grateful. You know, not because you got something that you really wanted, but because you don't want anything, and so everything is perfect for you. So this is what happens, and this is how people can be at peace in the world. Who people can be unafraid to do whatever they're doing, because they do have this assurance. So it's a beautiful thing that happens. And, you know, I do know people who are in there, in that place. So let's see, where are we at here? Paragraph 4? Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Okay. The main point is that a mind identified, I think that should be with love.
I think so too, yeah. Uh-huh.
Would appear to others in a form that could be accepted without fear, and to which others could create in a normal way, or could relate in a normal way. My vision is really kind of off today. The mind's purpose or content is the key factor, not the behavior. Okay, the purpose or the content is the key factor, not the behavior. Many Gnostics deliberately disobeyed the world's laws to prove that the world is not real. Well, by fighting against the world, they proved just the opposite. If you, I'm going to jump off this cliff and prove that gravity is not real. Whoops, up, boom. next, Darwin. Okay. If you are clear about the difference between form, behavior, and content, which is mind, you would be able to live in the world and abide by its rules without reinforcing the illusion in your mind. The body was not made by love, yet love does not condemn it and can use it lovingly, respecting what the Son of God has made and using it to save him from illusions. And that's from text chapter 18. And it says, there's a, in parens, Kenneth represents a detailed examination of this confusion as found in Gnosticism, the ascetic traditions, and other approaches in two of his books, Love Does Not Condemn, the World, the Flesh, and the Devil, according to Platonism, Christianity, Gnosticism, and A Course in Miracles, and The Message of A Course in Miracles, Volume 1, All Are Called. If you choose to listen, he shows how the course avoids the pitfalls of different moral traditions, leading to a formulation of a non-normative or new morality. And I'm sorry about all that reading, because I should have just posted that on the board. Basically, Ken Wapnick wrote a couple of things, one about Gnosticism and the ascetic traditions, and then about our relationship with the course, but talking about how those norms that I was just talking about, these ideas that we've come up with about how things should be, are not necessarily, and in fact not at all, real or moral or rules or laws of any kind that I need to adhere to. I'm under no laws but God's. You know, simple enough. And, you know, God did not make any of the rules and laws of the world. So there we go.
The only rule really to remember is that we all are perfectly innocent and beyond the realm of space and time. And that if we come from that awareness, we will automatically, be in a mindset that is the most kind and loving, and will not, be in a position where we tend to make choices that even appear to be unloving. You know, I think it just sort of removes us from. It doesn't mean that we don't have those lessons to learn. It just means that the more we see the inclusive interest in everyone, the more we find ourselves in a place to participate in a way that reinforces that in our own mind. And then because all minds are joined, it can, seems to propagate to quote others, but it's really just our mind that's being healed. It's my mind. No one else is on the hook for my salvation, because it's just my choice for which teacher I'm looking at any given moment.
Exactly. And you know, you just reminded me too of part of the question that this person was asking. Let me go back here and look, saying that until the majority of the sonship has realized this, we are bound to this illusion of matter.
Not a numbers game.
right. So the majority of the sonship is me. It's, you know, that's
right.
There's no majority of the sonship that's going to, you know, if all these people would hear about this course and start reading this course and start practicing forgiveness, then this, no, if I would do that, mm-hmm. that's all that needs to be done. There's no, I'm the only one that needs to be messing around with this stuff in any way at all.
Yep.
And if I think you need to be doing it,
it's all up to you, Lynn.
I'm in your business. Yes, it is all up to me. See, how do I even know? Why would I even think that A Course in Miracles would be right for anybody else? You know, that's my thought, and it's just my opinion. It might cause somebody else to commit suicide. Yeah, you know, which, you know, obviously that's not a bad thing either, but you know, my truth is good for me, and I don't need to make you believe what I believe. Simple and easy there. because that's
I think the curriculum
rules.
I was just going to say that the curriculum that we're studying is really one that leads away from needless sacrifice and needless suffering.
Exactly. Absolutely. Yeah. So do you want to read the next paragraph?
Sure.
Okay.
The main point is that a mind identified with love. Oh, we already read that one.
I read that one.
Okay. That's right. A Course in Miracles surely is not the final word in spirituality, as it is directed to those on the bottom rungs of the spiritual ladder. Okay, we can all raise our hands high in the air, i.e. all of us, as it says. But for those of us who have accepted it as our path home, it is more than sufficient, which is why Jesus says at the end of the 365 lessons of the workbook, this course is a beginning, not an end. We spend the rest of our lives applying its teachings to our personal lives. We needn't try to convince others to change how they go about their lives. Our focus is exclusively on how we choose to perceive others and the world. Therefore, seek not to change the world, but choose to change your mind about the world. Our only responsibility is to accept the atonement for ourselves. And the reference there is from chapter 2, section 5, and paragraph
5. If I do that, that I know everyone has done it because the sonship is one. As long as I believe that others still have to do it, my mind is not yet healed because I'm still perceiving the sonship as fragmented. A quick aside on this one. That, to me, that whenever I remember that, it's like a hugely helpful thing because in a sense, and in truth, really, we're already home just dreaming of exile. So if that's the case, the only one playing hooky from that perfect peace is me. And if I think that I'm, you know, everybody else is you know, struggling in a sense that that, you know, I have to wait until everybody else gets it, which is sort of the implication. And I think it's an easy trap to get into, which is why I think it's easy to kind of chuckle at this, because we all do it so frequently that, you know, boy, if they would just get it, you know, if this politician or that life partner or, you know, this coworker or this boss or, you know, the list goes on and on, would just, you know, fill in the blanks. And we keep wanting to fix the dream, which is why I keep coming back to one of my favorite metaphors is that we're all recovering dream repair technicians and we're all, you know, seemingly hopelessly addicted to wanting to do that. But there comes a time where we just realize, wait a minute, that has never worked. Why would I continue to try to beat that dead horse instead of just looking at the contents of my mind that was the motivation for making up the world? And then I can start to undo that investment. Okay.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's really the only thing that I can do. And, you know, once I get in my own business and stay out of other people's business, mm-hmm. it brings me a lot of peace.
Yeah.
It brings a lot of peace to just be able to say to myself, no matter what appears to be happening, you know, with my daughter, with, you know, the politics, with the world, just to be able to say, it's not my business. And, you know, I really just want to just let go of any opinion that I have of the goodness or badness of what appears to be happening. Uh-huh. And, you know, that brings peace. And if I'm not at peace, it's because I've got an opinion. Number one cause of being not at peace. And is really, honestly, it is miraculous how once you recognize that and admit to it every time it comes up, oh, here I am doing it again. You know, don't feel bad about it. Just let it go. Exactly. Recognize that nothing. I know nothing. Nothing.
the wisdom of Schultz and Hogan's Heroes. Yes, exactly.
I don't know what anything is. I don't know what anything is for. I don't know what the outcome of this is supposed to be. I have no idea. I have no basis upon which to plan anything or to make a decision about how I like it or I don't like it. You know, it's just insane to think that somehow or the other, my pitiful little ego mind has some impact on the overall accomplishment of the illusion or the overall accomplishment of the atonement. The fact is that I don't know the overall. All I know is me here now. So the only thing I can affect is me here now. And any illusion that I can affect anything else is an illusion, and it's not worth my time and trouble to deal with it. If
isn't
something
that
does need to be
Ram
done.
Dass's,
what's oh, yeah. Well, go ahead. Steps.
Go ahead and finish the thought. I just.
No, go ahead. I'm
oh, okay. I was thinking, wasn't that the original title of Ram Dass's book, Me Here Now?
I love it. Me Here Now.
Then he realized that ego wasn't going to cut it, so he had to change it to Be Here Now.
Oh, you're so funny. So yeah, anyway, that's it. You know, just stop trying to change the world.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And then that's how we get off, you know, if off the world, so to speak, off the identification with it, not by leaving it physically, but by leaving our identity as a victim of the world alone and just realizing that that doesn't cut it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'll finish this paragraph. If I do that, let me back up again to the quote from chapter 2. Therefore, seek not to change the world, but choose to change your mind about the world. Our responsibility is to, our only responsibility is to accept the atonement for ourselves. If I do that, then I know everyone has done it because the sonship is one. So I'm not waiting on anyone. It's just my individual remembering that is bringing me home. And everyone really is already home helping me. And everyone else in my world is an actor that I can afford to be incredibly grateful for, because each person reflects a decision for one teacher or the other, and there's just those two at any moment, and I can benefit from each moment regardless of what teachers others appear to have chosen, because it's all a facade, and I can remember that, you know, whether someone is expressing love or a call for love, it's a reminder that I can choose love and choose the peace that comes from that choice of thought system.
It's okay. The only choice. And it's funny, as you were talking, I was envisioning, this whole idea that I'm going to make it. I'm going to awaken. You know, I'm going to get there. And then I had this little vision. I might draw up a little cartoon of it, of this person going through this. Oh yeah, I'm going to do it. And finally becoming awake. And they open the door into the awakened world, and they look out, and there's everybody they know. They're like,
you know, that's amazing, because that's actually a dream that I had that was very powerful about 30 some odd years ago.
Probably really? 40.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It was basically this really horrific, dream, which I won't go into. Actually, I talk about it, I think, in my second book a little bit. But anyway, it was basically this, you know, kind of cataclysmic transformative dream where what I used to be essentially, died. And then I realized that these hooded figures that were dark and foreboding, that were accompanying me on this journey up the side of this mountain, when I got to the top of the mountain, they all took their hoods off and I could see their faces, and it was everyone in my world, you know, that had been helping me through this process. But I, at the lower levels, I saw them as these, you know, dark, you know, fearful figures, and then unveiled, they became the glowing, smiling, gentle faces of light that revealed to me that it was just my imaginary journey through that process that was necessary. And the only thing that was really necessary was for me to accept that I was already home. But it seems to be a long and laborious process, but it's really just a blink in a cosmic eye in truth, because it never happened.
Exactly.
Yeah. I'll go ahead and go ahead.
So when you do go through that door and you see everybody there and they all woke up and you're like, oh my God, how'd all you a-holes get in here? You recognize that, that they've all been home waiting for you.
Yeah. There's nobody left out. Exactly.
You've been there too. That's the thing. Yep. It's, not that you haven't been home as well. Oh, okay. Right. So I'll just read the last couple paragraphs here.
Okay. I don't think I finished that.
Oh, you didn't finish that one. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'll finish it real quickly here. I know we're running a little over. So,
that's okay.
But you said that we have a little time. Okay.
We have a little time. Yeah.
Okay. So, the middle of that third to the last paragraph says, if I do that, then I know that everyone has done it because the sonship is one. As long as I believe that others still have to do it, my mind is not yet healed, because I'm still perceiving the sonship as fragmented. And if we're waiting on someone else to get it, so to speak, this is a major difference between the Course's teaching and your belief that, quote, if we had mass consciousness believing along the same lines, this entire world as we see it would disappear and the sonship would become reunited. End of quote. If this were true, there would be actual parts of the sonship and some would be victims of others because these others still choose to remain separate. I think when you spell it out like that, it becomes obvious, but we're so used to the ego's babble and drivel that suggests otherwise, that we, I think we oftentimes don't even see it, do we?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a, because we have to be a victim.
Right. Right. Because we're really all attached to our victim scripts unless we look at them and see how dysfunctional and silly they are. And then the last sentence in this paragraph says, death is decidedly different from the entire thrust of Jesus' teaching in the Course, which is basically, hey, there's nothing holding you back. It's just my decision for misery in my mind that is perpetuating this, and I don't need to make that decision any longer. You know, why wait for heaven, as C.A. Brooks likes to say in her programs.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so, you know, this is one of those New Age kind of thoughts that comes in, this mm-hmm. idea that there's a critical mass, and that, you know, the conscious mind, you know, the oneness of the conscious mind at some point is going to be restored. The fact is, it's never been broken. It's never been broken. There's never been a reason for us to try to reattach ourselves to each other or reunite with each other. I mean, yes, of course, we use those words because that's the way we see things from this point of view of being an individual person. And, you know, what I think Jesus is urging us is to take another point of view, which he calls it above the battleground. Mm-hmm. And that other point of view, if practiced consistently, brings about this peace because you are seeing from a higher level. It's like, you know, you're in the middle of the battle and things seem terrible, but you go up to a higher level and you see that, you know, nothing is really happening and that it's just a play that's going on and all the movement is, you know, really just there to make an illusion of reality of the play. That's all that's happening. So, you know, this is what Jesus is telling us and urging us to see things from, see that perspective, to see things from that perspective. And so this is how, you know, to me, you know, my efforts are to doing that rather than to somehow or the other trying to make some kind of social, cause better. So, yeah. You know, it just, there's no point in engaging unless, you know, unless that's your path. I mean, if that's what you do, say you are a politician or a surgeon, you know, if you're a surgeon, you don't go in and say, you know, I know the body is an illusion, therefore it doesn't matter what I do here. Unless you are, you know, supremely connected to your higher self and it's connected to your higher self, you know exactly what to do and how to do it under all circumstances, then you don't have to worry about anything. And that's what Jesus is telling us. I don't have to worry about anything. I don't have to worry about what to say, what to do, how to act, where to go, what to eat, what to drink, nothing. You know, all this is given to me. And this is not a power, a superpower, or a super gift. It's the fact. It's the truth.
Yeah.
It's like saying I have a foot. You know, this body has a foot. Yes, of course it does. That's the truth. That's a fact. I don't have to wish for a foot. There's one right there at the end of my leg. You know, that's, you know.
That's your understanding, right?
Right. That's my understanding. And I have a big understanding. I have big feet. Okay. Great understanding. So anyway, let's finish this. One further thought about A Course in Miracles and its quote unquote evolution. It is impossible for a brain / mind as limited as ours to fully understand this course, which comes from a mind that transcends time and space entirely and is without limit. That, again, is why the course teaches that our only responsibility is to accept the atonement for ourselves. That's the only thing we have to do there. Because we don't know anything about anything else. We don't even know anything, we're hardly cognizant of our situation in any way at all. Therefore, how could we project something out that, you know, is anything real? You know, we're just really in a blind spot here.
Yeah, just being alert to and forgiving ourselves for indulging in ego's insane motivations, as this Do No Harm to Anyone article, suggests, would be, plenty to keep our minds busy in our forgiveness curriculum. So we don't really need to worry ourselves or bother with anyone else's atonement path,
Right, just, go on and find in some other way.
Yeah, exactly. We've got our hands full just looking at the contents of our own mind and seeing the desolation of the ego there. And I had to laugh a few minutes ago. You mentioned critical mass, and I was thinking, well, I'm not a Catholic, but the ego's priesthood always delivers a critical mass because it's always condemning, and that's its sermon. It basically, it's always saying that, we're evil, sinful, wicked, the home of evil, darkness, and sin, But that's not the reality. That's just the ego's misperception based on a belief in differences and separation. So,
exactly.
So if we can be alert to our internal critical masses, so to speak, use pun intended, and see when we're delivering that sermon to ourselves and each other, that can be a way out of it, that quagmire.
Absolutely, and it is the way out. It's actually the only way out.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, you start coming up with more plans and more decisions, and I think I'll do this, and I think I'll do that, and there's so much, and that's the ego. The ego is just doing, and we're already, we don't need to do no more, just stop. So I'm going to read this last paragraph. Finally, there's a lovely passage. Seems like more like a song Jesus is singing that blends with your belief that, quote, all works of good that a fellow brother does for another will be remembered in eternity in God's mind, unquote. We quote in part, how can you who are so holy suffer? All your past except its beauty is gone, and nothing is left but a blessing. I have saved all your kindnesses and every loving thought you ever had. I have purified them of the errors that hid their light, which really I think is the specifics of what happened. It's just taking away all the error and just being nothing but the light, and kept them for you in their own perfect radiance. They are beyond destruction and beyond guilt. They come from the Holy Spirit within you, and we know what God creates is eternal. And that's from chapter 5, section 4. Which is chapter 5 is just lovely.
But
this is it. It's the only, even the circumstances of the events, when this dream is over, we will not have a memory of specifics in the dream. Because that would be a memory of the illusion, and that the entire illusion disappears when we wake up. It is no longer seen as a reality to our mind, and we don't. So there's no, let me remember when Bruce was nice to me, that's inconsequential because everybody's been nice to me always. There's been no difference between anything anyone has done or not done in this illusion. It's all been an illusion the entire time.
Every actor has given a complete gift. Regardless of whether it appears to have been a call for love or an expression of love, and we shift our awareness to that perspective, we realize that gratitude is appropriate for everyone at every moment.
Exactly. Gratitude is appropriate, and appreciation, which is recognizing the true value of my brother. And when I recognize the true value of my brother, I wholly, fully appreciate him because I see that he's the Christ. And really, that's what this is all about, is seeing the Christ in our brother. So anyway, cool beans. You have any closing remarks, Bruce?
Not too much other than I always try to, post things that are interesting and, of course, related on ACIMblog.com. And, the Miracle Share folks are getting ready to launch a new website. And so I've been looking at that. And so a lot of fun things going on. And there's, as always, I always try to encourage people to to, you know, visit the two sister websites, so to speak, of ACIM.org and FACIM.org, which are the Foundation for Inner Peace and Foundation for A Course in Miracles websites, respectively. And anyway, just have a great week, everyone. And thank you, Lynn, as always, for all that you do and setting up these recordings and making them available and so forth and so on. So have a great week, all.
Well, thank you for being a willing partner. And I love you, Bruce. I appreciate you very much.
So much.
All right. All right. Talk to you next week.
Bye for now.